chaos. It's just the beginning. Every promise I made, I'm rescinding. That's Slipknot. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Jays win last night, but that leads a little bit about the weirdness in the middle of that game where the Jays put Kevin Kiermaier on waivers. They obviously put him on waivers before the game, but Joel Sherman of the New York Post reporting during the game that Kiermaier was on waivers, as explained after the game by Kiermaier, by John Schneider, that is not something that's supposed to come out. It's not something you're even supposed to have to tell the players necessarily. It's a procedural move. We'll explain a little bit of the detail of that to you throughout the show. It's nothing too much to worry about right now, but it is a signal that, yes, the Jays are going to sell a little bit. Yes, they'd probably be happy to shed a little payroll, maybe even get more aggressive, duck below that CBT line and reset the repeater tax for future years. We'll talk about all of that, fill you in on the Kiermaier situation. But right now, just a little bit of awkwardness. He's expected to be with the team tonight unless someone claims him. And yeah, around that, the Jays won a game 5-3. Kevin Kiermaier even had a really incredible catch in that one and a couple of hits, which has been pretty rare this year. We've got a loaded show for you. Later in the show, around 11:30, Shane Farrell, the Toronto Blue Jays amateur scouting director, is going to join us to talk about the draft that starts on Sunday. We'll have Nick Pecora to set up the Diamondback side of the series, Russell Dorsey of Yahoo, MLB Network, and Apple TV+. NXT and TNA wrestler Joe Hendry will join us for a couple minutes around 11. And right now, joined by from Blue Jay Central and on the radio call for this Diamondback series this weekend, it's Madison Shipman. Madison, how are you?
I am doing great. Thanks for having me again.
No problem. So you were doing Blue Jay Central last night with Brad Fay, and if you were doing the radio call with Eric Smith, as you are this weekend, I'd imagine you guys probably would have just ignored the Kiermaier thing, not having enough detail and stuff. But how much did that catch you guys off guard mid-game last night?
Yeah, because we're definitely listening to the game as it's happening, of course, and we're watching it. And so we both heard it, and we're kind of looking at each other, and we're looking around like, okay, so we got to find out some more details about this. But, you know, looking at Kevin Kiermaier's comments after the game, I don't know if I can think of a more professional way to handle that. It is a little bit awkward when the rest of the world is finding out in the middle of the game, especially when he had a really good game yesterday. Like you mentioned, those two hits, it looked kind of like Kevin Kiermaier that we saw last year, where he's not trying to pull the ball all over the field, but just taking what he's given, driving it the other way, and making an incredible diving catch out there, but handled it in an incredibly professional way. And he said that he's not going to be uncomfortable, and he understands where he's at, and he understands where the team's at, and he understands that it's a business decision, and that's just the reality of where this Blue Jays team is right now heading into the All-Star break.
Yeah, it's where they are, even with they've won a couple series in a row now, but they're still 7 games under 500. They're 8.5 games out of a wild card spot. We're pretty clear that they're going to be selling. The interesting component with Kiermaier going on waivers is, and again, we'll talk about this more a little later in the show and go through some of the CBT details, is, you know, this to me suggests they canvassed the market if there was just a straight trade. Now they're seeing, hey, would someone just eat the money? There's about $4.5 million owed to Kevin Kiermaier the rest of the way here, plus the Jays are into the competitive balance tax, so the tax money you have to pay on that as well. This is just, does anyone want him for free? And then from here, what you'd get to is the Cavan Biggio style, hey, we'll eat a little bit of the money, but give us a low-end prospect back, that kind of thing. You mentioned it. Kevin Kiermaier, very, very professional with it. Could be a big taxi squad tonight, because Bo Bichette's day-to-day and potentially an IL, so Dalton Varsho's day-to-day, and now who knows if Kevin Kiermaier is going to get claimed.
It just feels like, especially over what now, the past 48 hours, there have been so many little injuries, and then now this with Kevin Kiermaier, even Carlos Fabelis going down on the IL for half of a game. I guess he was back yesterday with his knee brace, but it just seems like all of these things all of a sudden are happening, and not just with the Jays up here in the majors, but also down in the minor leagues. And you look at some of those other players, Ricky Tiedemann, another one too. It just seems like a bad storm of all possible things happening at one moment for the Jays right now.
It's not been a great year.
Nope.
It's especially not been a great week. And yeah, the Kiermaier thing, for those of you unsure of the awkwardness, again, this is the waiver process, because he wasn't designated for assignment. He's not off the roster. You can put a guy through waivers while he's still on the roster. It's supposed to be a sealed process. Someone leaked it to Joel Sherman, some other team, I guess, or maybe Kiermaier's agent got wind of it or something like that. But it's not supposed to be as awkward as yesterday was. And there was even the day before, when Bo Bichette came out of the game, I got a bunch of tweets like hug watch, like is he out because he's traded? No, just the calf soreness there. So let's talk about the guys who did play yesterday. They come up with a 5-3 win to win that series against San Francisco. They get to old friend Jordan Hicks pretty well early on, and there are a couple guys who are seeing more playing time right now because of a Bobichet injury, because you've moved on from a Kevin Biggio. We could see more of that as the season goes. The three biggest ones getting a little more playing and the injury to Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, I should say. Ernie Clement, Spencer Horwitz, Leo Jimenez, all getting a little bit more time here and had solid games yesterday. Let's start with Ernie because he had been on such a power heater there, gets another hit yesterday, and steals a base. What have you seen from Ernie Clement now that we're, you know, seeing him a little bit more regularly at the plate?
I feel like we've talked about him quite a bit on Blue Jay Central this week just because of how well he's been hitting specifically. He's always going to go out there and make some really nice plays. I feel like he's pretty solid defensively. Every once in a while, the ball will get away from him a bit, but he's got some good speed. He's shown that he has power up at the plate. I like the adjustments that he's made with not necessarily his approach, but the way that he's able to hit a variety of different pitches. And you know that he wants to go up there and he wants to hit the fastballs, and he likes to swing at pretty much the first pitch every single at bat. I'm very shocked anytime he does take a first pitch just because he likes to be so aggressive.
Only his fourth walk of the season last night.
Exactly. And what I think going into the game, he had three walks in 172 at bats. That just tells you that he's not looking to take a free pass up there, but he also doesn't strike out a lot. And I joked because he doesn't even get himself an opportunity to get into a two-strike count because he's swinging so early in the count. But he's got great adjustability with his swing, too. So he's able to see a pitch out of the hand and make the adjustment with his barrel. But he was looking more for those fastballs, and then the league adjusted. They started to throw him more breaking balls, more off speeds early in the count because of how aggressive he was. So he worked on trying to stay a little bit more behind the baseball. And both of the home runs that he hit in that San Francisco series were, neither one of them were off of fastballs. One was off of a slider. The other one was off of a changeup from Logan Webb. And Logan Webb does not give up home runs. That was just the sixth home run that he had given up all season long. And Ernie Clement now among really top names as far as players that have hit home runs off of Logan Webb this year, whether it's Mookie Betts, Bryce Harper. Now you've got Ernie Clement up there is the one of the six home runs that he's given up on the changeup nonetheless.
Yeah, and one below the zone. I believe it was the lowest pitch that Logan Webb has ever surrendered a home run on, and one of the lowest in all baseball.
He did attribute that to his golf game, too. And he did practically have to golf it off of the ground, and I find that his stance, too, the way that his back's almost a little bit turned towards the pitcher, it's almost like closing off his stance a bit, but he's still able to somehow get barrel underneath that pitch, and thought it was a great comparison during the game. They also showed one of his home runs, I believe it was back in April, that he hit on a pitch that was so far above the zone. I think that that just speaks to the adjustability in his barrel to be able to adjust with maybe it's his stance or even the way that his bat path is going through the zone, depending upon what the pitcher's throwing at him, whether it's going to be those heaters that are up in the zone or a changeup that's practically rolling on the ground.
Yeah, and the other home run off Ryan Walker in the series, Ryan Walker had allowed like a 100 batting average when getting to a two-strike count. So being able to turn on that, and that was a breaking ball as well. And this is an important thing. Like, we all know, look, the defense is mostly there. A little, like you said, a little, the odd mistake this year, but reputation-wise, and, you know, you see the fluidity and things like that. The defense is there. He's the best base runner on the team other than maybe Kevin Kiermaier. And that, like, contact aggressive approach is there. But if you are going to stick around as a bench player, and especially if you're going to be, like, the 10th man instead of the 13th man, being able to show that you can hit more than just the fastball, that you can have an at-bat where you're not just attacking early in the count, pretty important to your ability to stick around for more than a half season or a season.
Yeah, and I think he's somebody where you don't necessarily want to rein in too much on the aggressiveness because that's what makes him the hitter that he is. But to your point, making sure that you can be aggressive not just on fastballs, but on a variety of different speeds and locations. And I do think that Ernie has shown that, especially really in the past week, that he's shown that he doesn't just get base hits off of them, but he can also hit for a little bit of power if he's able to get those hands extended in the barrel through the zone. So that's one thing that I've really appreciated from Ernie's play recently is those slight adjustments, whether it's even in his stance and the way that he's standing in the box or just even thinking about trying to get more behind the baseball, knowing that people are going to try to approach him with the breaking balls, with those off-speed pitches. But now he's found himself in a spot where pitchers aren't necessarily sure where they want to throw him because he's shown that he can hit it off of the ground. He can hit it above the strike zone. fastballs, breaking balls, it doesn't matter. He can find a way to get barrels of the baseball.
And maybe that's how you end up drawing a few more walks, is that pitchers have to be a little bit more.
I wouldn't hold my breath on that, but maybe the occasional walk, maybe more, a higher clip than 3 out of 172.
Only Harold Ramirez has as many plate appearances as Ernie Clement this year and has fewer walks. And he was, of course, DFA'd and is now a part-time guy with Washington. But Ernie Clement's also third last in strikeout rate. Luis Arraez and Stephen Kwan are the only guys who strike out less frequently than him. So fascinating profile Ernie Clement has.
Yeah, making contact with that many pitches can be a problem at times, but it just seems like he's able to find a way to still manage to get on base. And I like that he's not striking out a ton, which means he's going to put the ball in play, which at the very least could lead to a lot of productive outs rather than unproductive outs that often come with those strikeouts.
Yeah, and look, there is, you know, sometimes a narrative or an analytic thing about, you know, a walk is as good as a single, or a strikeout's fine compared to an out in play. But yeah, you lose that ability for a guy to go first to third, for to advance a runner and things like that. There are still small benefits to putting the ball in play, even if the results are not all that great.
Yeah, and I think he's somebody, too, that's not going up there trying to hit a three-run home run every single time. And that's something unique in his swing, similar to somebody like a Luis Arraez, who's not trying to go out there and just drive the ball out of the park every single time. But because he has that fine balance of swinging outside of the zone, but also not just trying to crank everything out to left field, I think that's where he's found some success. So that's why I'm not too quick to rein in the aggressiveness, because I do like it. I feel like there was a stretch, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, where there was like 5 or 6 consecutive at-bats where he just swung at the first pitch and put it into play. Not necessarily a bad thing, because pitchers oftentimes, what are they trying to do in an at-bat? They're trying to get ahead. They're trying to throw first pitch strikes. They're trying to get you behind in the count. So I do think that it can work to his advantage.
So a different hitter type, but someone else who's seeing more playing time with Bo Bichette and IKF down, is Leo Jimenez. We're only talking 17 plate appearances, but we heard the book on this guy coming up was, hey, pretty advanced approach at the plate. He'd add a little bit of strength for doubles, and you know, he had 7 homers in 55 games at the AAA level. Obviously, this is a guy who his major league career is going to be determined by the glove. But what have you seen from him in a small window here at the plate?
It's so fun, the game of baseball and hitting specifically, because there's no one right way to do it. Right. And when you compare Ernie Clement and Leo Jimenez, two completely different approaches up at the plate, Jimenez has a great eye, and I think he's shown that he has a lot of trust in his eye up at the plate just by the way that he's taking his pitches. You don't really see him out on his toes when he's taking a close pitch on the outside part of the plate. He understands the zone, and he trusts himself to make quality takes, even in a 2-strike count. And so because of that, I feel like he makes pitchers work in a different way than somebody like Clement has to do. And he ends up finding a mistake and puts a good swing on it. I think he also has a very fundamentally sound swing to hit a variety of different pitches. So his swing's not just tailored to hit fastballs, but he can hit breaking balls. He can hit pitches on the outside part of the plate. He can take sinkers in on the hands and still find a way to drive them out into the outfield because of the way that he keeps his hands inside the baseball. And when you're able to do that, your barrel staying behind your hands, the barrel staying in the zone longer, obviously leads to more opportunities to make quality contact on a variety of different pitches. So I've been impressed with just his composure up at the plate, and you could tell that he's not trying to do too much. And I feel like that's a phrase that we use over and over again with this Blue Jays team this year, but to me, he's the definition of somebody that's not trying to go out there and necessarily prove himself. Of course, he wants to do well, but he doesn't look like he's over trying to make sure that his stats are jumping off the page. But he's just doing what brought him to this point, and that's having a really good eye on both sides of the plate, but especially that low and outside part of the zone. I thought yesterday there were some really quality takes that completely shifted the course of an at-bat, because if you swing at a pitch like that, even if you're fouling it off, you're kind of playing into the pitcher's game plan. But when you're taking that pitch and it's getting called for a ball, they have to switch what they want to throw to you. And it ended up being Jordan Hicks that just kind of left a sinker right over the middle of the plate that he was able to drive up the middle for, I believe, his first MLB RBI.
Yeah.
Those little things, they don't seem like a lot. Those takes don't seem like a lot in the course of an at-bat, but they really can change the way that the pitcher approaches you.
And, I mean, from what is your long-term future perspective, that can be the difference between a bench guy and someone that they're comfortable throwing in there 120 times. Because if you're hitting 7, 8, 9 in the order, but you're having good at-bats, turning the order over, getting the pitch counts up, things like that, that stuff can matter. The big hit yesterday, kind of burying the lead here, waiting until 15 minutes into that. Spencer Horwitz puts one in the drink there. Yes, off a bounce, whatever. It still
counts in my mind. I'm counting it. Yes.
Did someone in a kayak get the ball? Yes absolutely.
There was a kayak scramble to go get that ball, too. Yes. That's always my favorite part.
So fourth home run already for Spencer Horwitz. He only had four in AAA this year over more than twice as many plate appearances. Obviously a guy who the reputation on him was, you know, bat the ball skill, approach, things like that. Are you seeing anything different than you expected when it comes to unlocking that power? Or is this just kind of, hey, the approach is so good, the swings are so good?
It's the swings and it's the approach and it's the consistency within those. And not saying that he's not going to strike out or he's not going to swing at a bad pitch every once in a while, but he just doesn't seem to get fazed by those things. And you can tell even in between pitches that he's always thinking, trying to think one pitch ahead of what the pitcher's going to throw him. And I think that one takes a lot of confidence, and you're seeing that within him. It takes a lot of trust within your own approach and to be able to sell out to a particular game plan. And I do think he's almost that nice combination of he'll be aggressive early in the count if he sees something close to hit, but he's also got a great eye when it comes to pitches that are maybe marginally on the outside parts of the zone. I like that he gets pretty close to the plate from the left side too, and he challenges pitchers to be able to throw him inside. But if you miss inside, he's got very quick hands to be able to make an adjustment on those swings too. So I've been impressed with all three of those guys. I like the power that Horwitz is showing. A lot of versatility with those three players too, which is always a plus. But the quality of their at-bats, the confidence in their at-bats, all a little bit in a different way too, which makes it even difficult for pitchers because you've got three different approaches even just wrapped up in those three guys that you're having to pitch to. So I really like what they've shown so far.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and this is kind of what the point of the season is going to be the rest of the way if the Kiermaier waiver and some trades happen is, you know, hey, what are these young guys showing? Are any of these potential bench pieces actually capable of an everyday role? You know, just getting to know what you have in those young hitters is important. And it's basically all we're going to talk about in August and September. So on the other side of the ball, Kevin Gausman had a really good start. So he's put two of those together in a row now. Very different one here. Last time out, I think he had 10 strikeouts. The splitter was really good. He talked about a mechanical change. And then last night, he's like, nah, I'm not going to use the splitter barely at all by his standards. He only threw 18 of them, which is by far the fewest he's ever thrown as a Blue Jay. A little bit more of that two-seamer we've seen him toy with. And then, yeah, just really leaned on the four-seamer in that one. It's not as if he was popping the radar gun, just seemed to feel comfortable with it. What did you make of the heavy fastball usage from Gausman yesterday?
I've always felt that it's important for Gausman to establish that fastball early in ball games, because when you're primarily throwing a two-pitch mix, so primarily he's going to throw that four-seam fastball and he's going to throw that splitter, at least historically that's what he's going to do. As a batter, when one of those pitches isn't established early, I can go ahead and knock that one off my list and just focus on the other one, whether it's going up there to sit the splitter or going up there just hunting those four-seam fastballs. But what I found in his approach really in the past three starts, by him establishing that fastball up in the zone and down in the zone, the one down in the zone coming out of his hand can look similar to that splitter because it's coming in the same part of the zone. And then as a batter, you're having to read the spin and try to figure out which pitch that is, which speed it's coming in at. I do think the velocity does make a difference. I know he likes to vary that velocity a bit. It'll even drop down to 92, 93, but especially the ones that are up in the zone, I find are more effective, and they probably feel like they're coming in a lot faster when they're 96, 97. But I do think that he was reading what the Giants were giving him yesterday, and he kept throwing fastballs, and they weren't making adjustments, and he was even piping some right down the middle, and they were just missing them. So if it's working for you, why change it? But I did find it interesting that we've seen the fastball usage continue to go up and up and up. 65% four-seam fastballs, I believe, in yesterday. And, that splitter usage down to 18%. And typically, coming into the game, like for the season, he had been throwing them around 33% of the time. So that's a drastic drop. The one home run that he did give up yesterday in the first inning was off of the splitter. So maybe that had a little bit to do with it. But when one pitch was working and the Giants clearly weren't able to make the adjustments, why change and go to something else? And maybe they were a team that was anticipating seeing more splitters. Maybe they were thinking about going up there and hunting that pitch. And maybe he noticed that and decided to just keep firing in those fastballs. But definitely something that worked. He historically this year has had much better numbers on the road this year. And I do think it has a part to play in it is the teams that he was playing in Toronto, right? The offenses that you're playing. But the Giants right around middle of the pack when it comes to offensive numbers in Major League Baseball this year, and he attacked them that way and clearly could not make an adjustment on that fastball. And felt like he was a real dominant presence from the beginning of the game, even with that home run off of the splitter. Those things are going to happen, but ultimately you're just trying to give your offense a chance to win the game, and he did exactly that.
Yeah, other than the one, I mean, Heliot Ramos had a Heliot of a series, a little bad pun for you there.
I like the bad pun. I appreciate it.
Before I let you go here and prep for tonight's series, the managers in the National League and American League All-Star Games will have to announce their starting picks. I think they have to announce them by Monday, so they can really drag this out. Paul Skeens, pretty good final argument for it.
Pretty good.
Getting yanked with 11 strikeouts, one walk, and zero hits through seven innings. Like, any time that, like, the tweet is, hey, here are the guys to do this in the history of baseball in their career, Nolan Ryan and a guy who just got called up and was drafted 1 year ago Sunday. You giving Paul Skeens the start in the All-Star game?
If I'm the manager in this situation, I am absolutely giving Paul Skeens the start in this one. And I do think that he has earned it in the starts that he has gotten this year. I know that's the question around baseball, is that he hasn't played long enough in the major leagues to necessarily earn that spot. But I do think that he's shown a lot of consistency in the starts that he's had. Plus, who doesn't want to see that 100-mile-per-hour heater and that nasty splitter that he's able to throw? And selfishly, I talked about it on Blue Jay Central. I want to see that matchup. I want to see the Aaron Judge going up against Paul Skeens. I want to see Juan Soto going up against Paul Skeens. I know Yordan Alvarez was pulled from a game 2 days ago, so I'm not sure if he's going to be playing in the All-Star game yet. But selfishly, I hope he does, because I want to see him face Paul Skeens. You want to see that power-on-power matchup and what he's been able to do in such a short amount of time. And like, he hasn't given up more than 3 runs in any one of his starts. And if anything is going to cap off already a great body of work for him, just in those 10 starts or 11 after yesterday, what he was able to do with those 11 strikeouts and 99 pitches and the efficiency that he showed yesterday, I say give him the start.
Yeah, a little different to see Paul Skeens against Aaron Judge, Juan Soto, Gunnar Henderson, than, hey, he comes in the seventh and here's Willie Castro and Isak Paredes, who do nice hitters, but it's not moving the needle quite the same way.
And would I be upset if somebody like Ranger Suarez gets the start? Absolutely not, because Suarez has had an incredible season this so far as well. So I'm not going to be upset if he doesn't get the start, but I guess I'm talking from a very selfish standpoint that those are the matchups that I want to see. So if I were a manager in that situation, you know exactly who I'd be putting on the mound.
Yeah, it's the reverse thinking of, you know, it's a bullpen game, right? So it's like, think of it like the opener. We don't like the opener, but it's the All-Star game, so you kind of have to do glorified bullpen game. Madison Shipman, thanks so much for taking the time out. Have a great call this weekend.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Madison Shipman of Blue Jay Central. She is on the call with Eric Smith on the radio side this weekend. Jays against the Diamondbacks. Yariel Rodriguez against Ryan Nelson. Tonight, Jose Berríos against Yulber Diaz. Tomorrow at 10:10 on a Saturday. And then Sunday, 4:10, Yusei Kikuchi against Zach Gallen. Then it's the All-Star break. And we have no shows next week, which is wonderful. Let's take a break. When we go back, Russell Dorsey of Yahoo Sports, MLB Network, and Apple TV Plus joins us as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A lot of pre-taped interviews for you today. Getting that work in earlier in the week. Right now, we're going to go to one. We had a chance to sit down with Russell Dorsey of Yahoo Sports, of MLB Network, of Apple TV Plus. Talk to him to get you ready for the trade deadline. He has been probably the insider and analyst voice who has been most aggressive about, yeah, the Jays should trade Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Even if we don't think those outcomes are particularly likely, it's still good to hear that perspective and kick around what it could look like. We also talk some fun all-star stuff, some home run derby stuff. This is that interview with Russ Dorsey.
Joined now by national MLB insider at Yahoo Sports, MLB Network, Apple TV Plus. He's everywhere, man. Russell Dorsey joins us now. Russell, thanks for doing this, man. How are you?
I'm doing well, Blake. How are you?
I'm good, man. Not as good as you. I'm not talking to Vladdy on Espanol. man, that was cool. Yeah. Man, how'd you feel coming out of that? So for anyone who didn't see it, you interviewed Vlad, but not just interviewed him, spoke to him in Spanish, met him at his level, and you're not a native Spanish speaker initially. I imagine that was pretty cool.
Yeah, like we had him on our show on MLB Network, and it's something that actually my mom has been very big pushing me to do because I've been learning Spanish since I was like 12, 13. And, you know, in Chicago, in a city where we have a lot of Latinos, it's something that you pick up. And then obviously I studied in school and did the whole honors AP thing and studied a little bit in the Dominican. And so as I started my career as a reporter in baseball, it was just something that I used, you know, in one-on-one settings, in different environments where I could help a guy feel more comfortable. But I'd never done it on TV before because it was a comfort thing for me, right? Because I'm so, like, I hate getting things wrong. And so in Spanish, like, for people out there that are listening, like, for a word that you say in that would be one thing in Dominican Spanish is different in Colombian Spanish or Venezuelan Spanish or Puerto Rican Spanish or Mexican Spanish. And so because of all that, you kind of have this fear. But I think to your point coming into this, it's like you want to meet somebody where they're at. And being a reporter, for me, it was always, well, these dudes come over and we just expect them to just learn English, but it never goes the other way. And it's something for me where, like, well, the blessing for me as a reporter is, well, I do know Spanish, right? And I think that's something that I can use to help a guy feel comfortable. And so in that moment, I could tell that Vladdy really appreciated it. I could tell his translator really appreciated it. And he could have that 45-second break where he didn't have to translate a question. But yeah, I think it's something for me that's really important to always try to meet players where they're at and make players feel comfortable so that they understand that, hey, it's not always on you to be the one to cross that aisle.
No, it's great, man. And it's, I mean, obviously you have a comfort level with it. I come from a city here in Canada that's like heavy Portuguese. So I'm not Portuguese, but the Raptors had two Brazilian players a couple years ago. So I like just drop it in once in a while, like, hey, good game. How's your 3-point shot or whatever, but never on air, man. So kudos to you for doing that and having the courage to do that and the confidence to do it. How was your chat with Vlad, Spanish aside?
No, it was good. It was good. It was... You know, it's an interesting situation for Vlad, I imagine for Bobuchet as well, when we're a couple of weeks away from the trade deadline. Your team's not playing well. You're playing well in the case of Vladdy, not so much for Bo. And the thing that you know covering athletes is the whole, I don't hear, I don't see. It's never true. Guys hear and see everything. MLB Network's on in clubhouses. ESPN is on in clubhouses. And so you're seeing me or passing, you're scrolling on your feed, you're seeing Ken Rosenthal and John Heyman and Joel Sherman talking about things that we're hearing, talking about what a good move for a team to make. And the Blue Jays are in conversation and not for the greatest of reasons if you're a Blue Jays fan. And it's one of those things where, he's been a good soldier in that, hey, he's still having a good time. He's still smiling and playing really, really good baseball, which I think is the most important thing for not only Vlad, but for the Blue Jays, as you kind of have to make some tough decisions in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, they do have to make those tough decisions. And I think, you know, 8.5 games out of the wild card, some of those decisions have been made. Like, you're not buying. That part's right. Clear. But there is a pretty interesting debate to be had about, you know, do you sell just the guys who are about to be free agents and your eyes are on competing again in 2025, or you blow this whole thing up? And I know you did a video essay the other day at Yahoo Sports kind of looking at this question. I'll ask you this from an analyst perspective, not from a reporter perspective. What do you make of the situation the Blue Jays are in? Do you see that path to, hey, if they only do a modest sell, competing again in 2025, or in your opinion, does this need to be bigger?
I look at it and I step out and I say, okay, 2 years ago, just two, I picked the Blue Jays to win the World Series. That's how much I believed in that group, right? That's how much I believe in the group that they have on the field right now. And it just hasn't worked, right? Like, just the mix has been off and I don't know what it is. Cause you look on paper and like, these are damn good players that any team would love to have a handful of those guys, let alone to have a staff that has Kikuchi and Jose Berrios and Kevin Gausman, right? And to have Vladdy and Bo Bichette and George Springer in a lineup, and it just has not worked. And it's one of those things where you look at that bullpen and what it was a couple of years ago, and it was one of the best in baseball, led by my former classmate Jordan Romano in the back end, and it just hasn't worked. And then Jordo goes down with the elbow injury, has surgery, and then you have to, you know, wasn't pitching that well before the injury. And it just seems like everything that has gone wrong, or could go wrong, has gone wrong for them as a team. And so you look and you say, okay, is there anything you can salvage from this group, right? And you say, man, like, I would hate to trade a Bo Bichette. I'd hate to trade a Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but you have to be realistic. And it's something that if people watch me or see what I write all the time, it's something that you're probably annoyed at me saying, but it's something that's very true in this era of the third wild card, where GMs and president of baseball ops have to be so honest with themselves. And it's something that's really tough for executives to do, because it's like, you can easily talk yourself into going for it with the third wild card spot if you have a good week, right? If your team, like, look at the Chicago Cubs. They have not looked like a playoff team the majority of the first half, outside of a good month of April. And they've been beaten up on the Baltimore Orioles, who are a really good baseball team. And so if you're Jed Hoyer and Carter Hawkins, you could say, you know, the National League's down this year, and, you know, we're only four games out. You know, we had a good week and get some guys hitting with our pitching. And you see how easy that is to talk yourself into it. And so if you're Marcia Pyro and Ross Atkins, you got to get yourself out of that. Now, the Blue Jays are in a much bigger hole than four games, and the climb in the American League is a much tougher climb than in the National League. So I think you really probably have to – if you move Bo and Vladdy, I think you should just do the entire thing and tear it down and build it back up. And I think the argument against that would be something similar to what the Mets have, where – at the end of the day, even if you do a medium-sized retool, we'll call it that, you do know you have the means to go out into the free agent market and spend, right? It's why they were one of the finalists for Shohei Ohtani. Everybody's not in that boat. And so if you still have that ability to write check in the wintertime and you can make some moves to get yourself in a position where you could still be competitive, and then you make a big splash in the offseason, it doesn't have to be this thing where you're rebuilding for 4 to 5 years.
Right, and it's a tough spot from a fan base perspective, and I imagine from a front office, where you just described how quickly teams can get back in the playoff picture, right, in the wild card era. And this core had loftier expectations than that. It was World Series contention, not getting the wild card. But you squint, and it's like, okay, well, Vlad's a little better, Bo's a little better, spend a little money, and then you're back in the wild card mix. It's a tough one. That's an easy sell from like a business perspective too. Like they just spend $400 million on stadium renovations and stuff like that. They don't want that place empty. So it's a tough one. So let's put out the scenario where they only do the modest retool. I know you've done a lot of stuff at Yahoo Sports the last couple of weeks. Hey, these are contenders. This is what they need. This is, you know, hey, I like this fit. The Blue Jays have a couple of pending free agents. Yusei Kikuchi on the starting pitching side, Jimmy Garcia in the relief pile, Danny Jansen as a catcher, a couple other spare parts. Who are you looking at? If you're a contender and Ross Atkins puts out the sell signal, who are you coming after? Who are you trying to vulture here?
You're probably listening on Vlad first and saying, all right, if you're Ross Atkins and you call the Astros, you call Dana Brown and say, look, I know you're looking at first baseman and you're looking for solutions, not only short term, but long term as well. I have a guy that would make quick work of the Crawford boxes down there in Houston at Minute Maid Park. It would be Vlad first and then Kikuchi, because starting pitching is so expensive, not only at the deadline, but in free agency. You could get yourself a nice prospect in return for a guy who's had a really, really solid season for the Blue Jays, one of his best seasons in a while. And so those would be the first two guys I would listen on. And the thing with Bo is you'd be selling at his low point, right? We've seen Bo be the best hitter in Major League Baseball. We've seen Bo be the best hitter in the American League. We've seen him leading a lineup that was top five in runs scored. And you know it's there, right? Like, he's been very consistent over the last couple of years. I don't know if you move him at the deadline, especially if you're going to do the modest rebuild. Let's say you still are interested in moving him. You'd probably be better off moving him in the offseason, right, where a guy like a Willy Adames is going to be a free agent. And the team that misses on Willy Adames, you could easily say, all right, well, I have Bo Bichette here. I know he has one more year before he becomes a free agent, but you need a shortstop. And then that maybe opens up your shooters a little bit more. And maybe a team that's not in it right now will be in on Bo Bichette in the offseason. That would be one way to look at that as well. So, yeah, I'd start and swing big on Vladdy if that could get you the type of haul with a year of club control after this season and a two-month window where he's looked like the 2021 Vladdy over the last 6 to 7 weeks.
Another name that you had mentioned in one of your pieces, and this was for the Milwaukee Brewers, even after the Dallas Keuchel and Aaron Saval additions, was a Chris Bassett. Now, everything the Jays have signaled here in Toronto, at least, is, you know, guys with term are not untouchable, but like you're going to have to really pony up if you want guys with term. But Chris Bassett is like 35, and, you know, there is 1 year left, and I don't know that you could do better than Chris Bassett, you know, with 1 year and $22 million next season. But let's say Chris Bassett is available. What is the price tag on something like that, do you think, given how few sellers there are in the starting pitching market?
Yeah, I mean, if you get yourself into a situation where, one, I love Chris Bassett, always has. I think he's a guy that uses all four quadrants of the strike zone. It's not the most elite stuff, but the guy knows how to pitch, right? And has done it in different markets. He's done it in New York. He's done it in Oakland. He's doing it now in Toronto. And so that's the type of guy that you just need where it's like, hey, this could be our number two in a rotation. This could be our number three in a rotation. A really good rotation. Now you're feeling really good going to the postseason where you're like, if Chris Bassett's our number three, we feel really good. And I look at a team like the Milwaukee Brewers and what they're able to do with starting pitching and the team they have here. Like if you say I have Freddie Peralta and Chris Bassett going 1-2 in the postseason, I feel pretty good. I feel better than most teams probably would. Sure, if you have a Garrett Crochet or something like that, you're feeling very, very good. But I think you could do a lot worse than Chris Bassett. And you have a guy who's a veteran and knows how to pitch. And the moment doesn't really fluster him, you know. That could get you a decent prospect at the deadline, especially if you move him like on deadline day, like on Tuesday when you have a lot of teams calling. Maybe there's a guy that you wanted that got moved already. Maybe one of these teams that misses on Garrett Crochet. Maybe you look to say, all right, well, Chris Bass is a guy that we could pencil into our rotation for sure. I think one of the things with Crochet that the White Sox are probably having to deal with in terms of making a move is he's never pitched this many innings. And this is his first year coming back from Tommy John surgery. So if you're a team acquiring him, you're like, well, am I trading for an ace in a rotation? Or am I trading for a guy that I'm going to have to skip four of his starts in the second half, maybe put him in the bullpen, and I have to pay elite starting pitcher prospect capital to get him? That might be tough. I think the other thing, if you're Toronto, you got to think of the rental market. So we talked about Kikuchi, but if a guy like a Max Scherzer is available, that's something that you'll have to deal with, right? That'll be something where it's like, all right, maybe that causes us to let's move Kikuchi instead. Like maybe there's just for what it's going to cost to get Chris Bassett because of the year of club control after this year, maybe it might be a little bit more expensive where a team might be more willing to try to acquire Kikuchi.
All right, zooming outside of Toronto here, you mentioned Garrett Crochet. That probably the best player you could see moving. I know you'd kicked around, you know, a Mason Miller, a Cody Bellinger if things went poorly for the Cubs. We've heard Luis Robert's name out there as a possibility. Who do you think is the best player that is conceivably available?
Yeah, so being in Chicago and being able to have a little bit of a pulse on both sides of town, I think of all those names, it would be really tough for the White Sox to move Luis Robert Jr. I'm not saying that it won't happen because I imagine and have heard that there have been teams that have called for obvious reasons. But the haul it'll take to get Luis Robert Jr., a guy who's been a Gold Glover and you know coming back from injury has looked like his healthy self. It's going to take a decent haul to acquire Luis Robert with years of club control left. I'd say Crochet is probably the most attainable. And I look at that for this reason. The Dodgers are in. You have a team like the Padres that, because of the Dodgers, are going to be in. You have a team like the Baltimore Orioles that probably should have, they were, you know, in on Dylan Cease at last year's deadline. Obviously don't acquire him. You get bounced in the playoffs. And then Kyle Bradish goes down with the torn UCL, Tommy John surgery. You don't have John Means either. And so they really, really need some starting pitching. And if that's the difference between you feeling like you can go out and win the World Series, that's a move you got to make. And so I think Garrett Crochet, because of all the big boys that are going to be in on him at the deadline, is probably the most likely and probably the best player that gets moved. But as we know with the deadline, there's always surprises. Like, I think if Vladdy gets moved, that's the biggest name. Like, I think Crochet this year has been the better player, put that in air quotes, Vladdy getting moved is a big deal. Right? Like, I don't know. Even Pete Alonso, a guy like that, that's a significant name. So I think there'll be some, you're going to hear some interesting names thrown around. Those names don't often get moved. And I know people, like, you're looking on Twitter. I get it. There are a lot of people reporting a lot of things. There's some really good reporters out there. Sometimes you got to take things with a grain of salt, because one thing that I've learned as a reporter on the beat and now as a national reporter is, a lot of guys get thrown out in conversations of, hey, we've called to check in, right? There's a lot of teams checking in a lot of dudes. Dudes that you would never think somebody would check in on. You at least make the call and say, hey, are you interested in moving this guy? Now, sometimes you get a hell no, but sometimes you get a, hey, for the right price. And that's where conversations get started.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, there are conversations about, like, the last guy in bullpens, because if he gets DFA'd, maybe you do a waiver trade, right? Like, there's nobody that's not getting talked about. Okay, before we hit the trade deadline, Russell, it's also All-Star Weekend coming up here. I assume you're going to be down there.
I am.
What are you most looking forward to? Is it the derby, the game, the kind of socialization with other media? What's the best part of All-Star for you?
I think of big-time events in baseball on the media side. It's like the first day of school, right? So I think of the winter meetings like the first day of school. I think of the All-Star game like the first day of school. I think of the World Series like the first day of school, where you're seeing all your friends that you haven't seen in so long. You get to come together in one spot and have a good time. I'm looking for, as far as the events, I'm really looking forward to the Home Run Derby, for the simple fact that we are seeing a changing of the guard, and you look at some of the guys that are involved, right? I think Jose Ramirez, for a long time, was the most underrated player in baseball, right? Making a return to the Home Run Derby. He's an absolute stud. Younger guy as well. I think you look at Bobby Witt Jr., hometown kid, grew up 25 minutes away from Globe Life Field, where All-Star Week will be. That's a really cool story. Also, another one of the budding young superstars in Major League Baseball. Gunnar Henderson, what have we seen from him this year? Guy's going to finish top five in AL MVP voting. One of the budding superstars in the game. So I love that you're seeing the young stars of the game in prime time. I love seeing that a guy like Ellie De La Cruz is going to be there and going to do crazy things. Guy has damn near 50 bags at the break. We haven't seen that in so long. So I like seeing the young superstars in the game, you know, really be able to grow. And we're seeing them growing before our eyes, because, look, Max Scherzer is 40 years old. Justin Verlander is 40 years old. Like, these guys who have been part of – and look, I'm 29, so I remember when Justin Verlander debuted. I was in the fifth grade. I'm not in the fifth grade anymore. And guys like that are you know, retiring and going to the Hall of Fame and et cetera. So you need some new young superstars, and I feel like there's a really good crop coming right now.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I need those guys to hang on a little bit. I don't want to look at the point where I'm older than everyone in the league. I'm 38, so I'm getting close there. It's like, Charlie Morton, please hang on a little while longer.
Charlie, please keep pitching.
Exactly.
And he might.
Yeah, he very well might. Jamie Moyer-ing it. And you had made the point, I know you made the point around Paul Skeens too, of like, you know, marketing should always be secondary. But baseball's in a really good spot that the Home Run Derby, the All-Star Game, you know, just who's exciting right now does skew so young, right? Like, it's happening naturally without the marketing muscle.
I think I've heard a lot about Paul Skeens over the last couple of weeks, but I never wanted to get lost how good that dude actually is. Like, Paul Skeens, his last year, 365 days, has been insane. Guy wins the college. He wins player of the year in college, wins the College World Series, is the number one overall pick in the draft that was a year ago, goes out, kills it against minor league competition, makes his debut, killing it in the big leagues, all-star in 365 days. It's insane. And could cap that by starting the all-star game. Like, it's unreal. And even though I think there are other guys that are deserving of that, do I think it's the worst thing in the world if Paul Skene starts the all-star game? Absolutely not. Because I think it is, that is a guy that you want center stage all the time.
I haven't seen a young guy rise like this since you were the youngest beat writer in all of Chicago back in 2020, man. So.
Stop it.
Russell, man, thanks so much for taking the time out. Have a great time at All-Star.
My guy, I appreciate you.
Russell Dorsey, MLB Insider at Yahoo Sports, Apple TV Plus, and MLB Network.
All right. That was a fun chat with Russell. I should have just kicked it to commercial in the pre-tape. We'll do that now. When we come back on the other side, we'll have a little fun with Joe Hendry, the professional wrestler. We'll also talk to Nick Bocoro of the Arizona Republic to set up the Diamondbacks side of this series. Shane Farrell, Toronto Blue Jays amateur scouting director, also joining us in the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Had the chance to sit down with TNA wrestling star Joe Hendry the other day. He's also been popping up on WWE NXT, which you can check out every Tuesday on Sportsnet 360. Catch up with it, including NXT Heatwave, where Joe Hendry teased his eventual return to NXT on Sportsnet Plus. TNA Slammiversary goes down April 20th in Montreal, or July 20th. April 20th would be early promotion right here. July 20th. In Montreal, it's almost sold out already, so check that out. Here is our sit down with one of the hottest stars in wrestling, especially online, Joe Hendry.
Joined now by Joe Hendry, one of the hottest superstars in not just TNA but NXT. Joe, what's up, man? It's been a minute. A lot has changed for you in the 18 months since I saw you last.
Yeah, a lot has changed in the last 2 or 3 months. It's a wild time. And I'm enjoying every moment.
It seems like a blast. I had Shawn Michaels, HBK, on the show a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about this kind of NXT TNA crossover stuff that's been happening. And I mentioned your name. I thought maybe he'd bite on it and give something away. He didn't. And then you show up in that Battle Royal the other week. Man, can you walk me through a little bit about how, you know, this TNA NXT crossover stuff has worked and how, you know, how you got approached to be a part of it or raised your hand to be a part of it?
No, I absolutely cannot, because that's a secretive part of the industry. Nice try, though. I do respect it. But I guess this is all you got to know, really. What I will say is this is what is kind of out there is, you know, a lot of the time, for example, when I did the first appearance, it was, you know, I'd heard some rumblings, but it was really only confirmed the day before. And then the challenge was just right, we got to get me from LA to Orlando, which was a bit of a challenge. But I actually thought that really helped, because it's almost like, you know, when MMA fighters talk about the first battle is making weight, so they don't really have time to overthink the fight. I kind of felt the same with my situation. It was right, I got to get to Orlando. That was the first battle. And then by the time I got to Orlando, I was just tired and ready for bed. So I had a great sleep and then woke up the next day, felt awesome. And it was just, yeah. What I will say, though, is my interactions with WWE have been absolutely everything that you would want them to be. You know, it's just to be able to represent TNA in this way. I love TNA. And I love WWE's product, and to be able to do great business with both of them in a way that it benefits everybody is the dream situation. You know, I was talking to someone at WWE yesterday and I was like, you know, this is really cool that we get to do this. And he said to me, never seen it before. And it's just it's such a historic thing that we're doing, you know, when you think about it. So it's very exciting. To be able to do what we do and represent TNA, and at the same time learn from Shawn Michaels and Matt Bloom and Johnny Russo and, you know, the other great staff that they have down there. It's it's happening so fast that I really I'm trying my best to take it all in and enjoy it, but it's just, yeah, I think they say sometimes you don't realize that you're in the good times until they're over, but I'm really, really trying to stay present and enjoy every second, because I just can't believe it's happening, really. And I've just had nothing but positivity from the fans. It's, yeah, I can't really put it into words. When the fans see those videos of me walking out and I'm looking out around just going, damn, is this really happening? It's a very real reaction.
And it looks like you're having a blast, man. So I did want to ask about that, right? You show up this first day, and obviously people know you. The song has done what it's done on the UK charts and become a bit of a viral thing. I won't ask you to rehash all of that with us, because I know you're probably talked out about it at this point. But that's a real thing, and that's online, and that's a TNA audience. Was there any part of you that wondered, hey, would the NXT audience, when I show up there, the music hits, the big smile hits, like, would they know, would they get it? Was there any apprehension on your part?
There was no apprehension. I thought it would get a good reaction, but Steve Corino, Tommy Dreamer, and Sean seemed to know in advance that it was going to be the reaction that it was. Like, they told me that they thought it was going to go really well. And I thought it would go well, but I just, you know, to have WWE's most watched video on Twitter of the year, when you consider all the megastars that are involved in that, it's very surreal. It's awesome. And sometimes it's, you know, when you're around great people and you're in a great environment and you're collaborating together, you're having fun. And, you know, like I say, I've got people from TNA and WWE all working together collaboratively, and it's just fun and awesome and everything you would want it to be. But you sometimes, when you're doing it, you're having fun, and then in retrospect you realize the grandeur of what you've actually just gone and done. Like, to me, like, I just wrestled a show at the weekend in Scotland for a company called CPW in front of, like, you know, 150-200 people, and had an absolute blast. And then I just got a similar fun feeling, but obviously on a different scale, but I just had that same buzz of just wrestling in front of people. And then, you know, when you get back to the hotel and you look on your phone, you're like, oh yeah, like, a lot of people see this, you know? And it's surreal in the best possible way.
It looks like you're having a blast. And I caught the NXT main event last night. For anyone who missed it on Sportsnet 360, you can watch it on Sportsnet Plus. You come out as the surprise partner for Trick Williams in the main event there. Huge ovation. And yeah, you talk about doing big things. Not only are you one of the first guys doing this TNA WWE crossover, but you win in the main event. You get the pinfall and everything. So it's, yeah. You know, I don't know. I think sometimes when people hear this stuff or think of these crossovers, they're like, oh, the one company is going to dominate. You know, you think back to WWE, WCW invasion, where all the WCW guys are just lost or whatever. No, man, you're winning the main event. I'd imagine it's a pretty fulfilling feeling. I wanted to ask you, like, more generally. So again, for anyone who doesn't know, you and I crossed paths like maybe 18 months ago. I was commentating for Smash Wrestling here in Toronto, and you and I talked. I actually helped you film one of the videos, the Canada FEM video.
Yeah, I feel like such an, like, when you first came on, like, I'm just so jet lagged. Like, I actually was like, oh, we've got each other on socials, right? And you know, we've had very meaningful interactions, so I very much apologize for that.
No, dude, it's okay, man. Yeah, I know you're doing a ton of media, and you're, like you said, you just got back from Scotland and everything. But so we had a conversation.
I'm about to fly.
Oh, sorry, about to fly.
We're about to get it done. Yeah.
See, I'm still jet lagged
from when I got here. It's but sorry, carry on.
No, so we had a conversation that day, and I was curious about some of the, you know, changes you'd made. Obviously, you bulked up a little bit, changed your style, dyed the hair, and you said something to me, you know, you had thought about how to get to that next level, because these videos you've done about your opponents and things like that, you've always done a good job creating buzz for yourself in the organizations you're in. But you had kind of said to me, hey, you know, you thought about it, and why would a kid buy a Joe Hendry action figure? And that's kind of what went into some of the changes. So, you know, obviously the meme or the viral aspect of this is a part of it, but how much do you feel like this is kind of the culmination of you kind of spending a couple of years here changing who Joe Hendry is as a wrestler?
Well, I think now it's just the I'm always learning now, and I just, what I do is I rate myself out of 10. And I started with 3, but I now think there are 5 ways that you need to rate yourself. Your look, your in-ring ability, your promo and your charisma, your ability to promote yourself, and your professionalism, sort of easiness to deal with type thing. I think those are the 5 most important metrics that any pro wrestler can pay attention to. And if you just look at those things and go, what is my physique out of 10? You know, if Batista's a 10 and, you know, just Jabba the Hutt's a 1, then, you know, where am I type thing. Same with, do it with your in-ring work, do it with your charisma, your ability to promote yourself, and then with a professional thing, it's like, am I a pain in the ass to deal with, or am I pretty easy to deal with? You know, like, just thinking about those things, I think if you aim to improve all of those things, like, by 1 point out of 10 every 3 to 6 months, pretty soon you're going to be where you want to be. And that's exactly what's happened to me. So for anyone listening, they want to know what the secret is, that's it, you know? And also be a songwriting genius, but that's the thing.
That's a helpful part of it. Okay, so I'm asking you about some WWE stuff here, but you have a pretty big TNA event coming up. TNA Slammiversary is taking place in Montreal on July 20th. I know you've been to Canada a handful of times. This is going to be the biggest match of your career. You're in a world title match at TNA Slammiversary there for you. How much are you looking forward to that? What's kind of front of mind for you as you head into Slammiversary in Montreal?
I'm just very much looking forward to it. You know, I've said to many people that I feel like I'm on a hell of a run right now. I feel like I'm really a key part of TNA doing some historic business right now. And I take a lot of pride in that. And that was always my goal. I've always said that in interviews, my goal was to be someone that when TNA announced me, tickets shift, you know, t-shirts shift. Like, I add to the business element of TNA. So to be able to now have taken that along with all the improvements I've made and to walk into the main event of the biggest show that we've done in over a decade, that feels pretty good.
Have you done Montreal before? Like, have you wrestled there? Have you gotten the experience of the city at all?
So I did I did a pretty extensive Canada tour in 2017 or 18. I need to go and check my cage match on that one.
Nice. I imagine you're not doing songs in French. Enough people speak English in Montreal that you'll probably be fine there too.
Well, we believe we've got a t-shirt out that's OUI believe. So there you go. That can be my contribution.
It's a good one. Man, looking forward to that. Last one for you. Olympics are coming up here. I know you were a freestyle wrestler, like, by trade coming up. How do you find that, like, obviously, like, there's the Kurt Angle example of, like, a guy who comes from gold medal right in, but that kind of background, freestyle wrestling background, to kind of build your wrestling from, how helpful did you find that as you kind of trained as a pro wrestler?
Well, I actually only started amateur wrestling after I'd already begun my pro wrestling career. So I started
gold medals right away in the British scene. No big deal.
Yeah, I mean, I just looked at it strategically, and I thought that, you know, I learned from Chael Sonnen, who explained that the higher up the weight classes you go, it's more about strength and conditioning rather than technique. The lower the weight classes you go, it's you've got technical wizards. So I thought, well, I'm starting a sport at 26. I can't, you know, make myself a amateur wrestling genius right off the bat, but I'm pretty goddamn strong, and I'm, you know, and I'm pretty well conditioned. So I was like, you know, actually, I'll keep building on this. I'll seek the heavier weight classes. And again, if you think about it, if your average person, let's say the average person walking around who's, like, you know, in like sort of normal build is probably, you know, let's say 180, 190 pounds, whatever. And then if they then train amateur wrestling like freestyle or Greco, they'll probably tighten up a bit and lose about 10 pounds. So most of the population, if they were to become athletes, would float around the 170 pound mark. So I was like, well, if I operate around the sort of 200 pound mark, I'm going outside the bulk of the population. So with the heavier weight classes, you're there would be less people to compete with as well. So less technique required, less people to compete, smaller sample size, with it being, you know, the UK, I was like, actually, there's only going to be a handful of really talented people that I'll need to beat. And I just drove up and down the country finding them and just, you know, just kept at them every week. Every week, I just found anyone that could beat me until there was no one in the UK that could beat me. And no one did for 2 years.
Pretty incredible, man. That's a pretty incredible backstory. Your come up here on the pro wrestling side has been pretty incredible. It's WWE NXT on Sportsnet. It's TNA Slammiversary in Montreal on July 20th. Joe, thanks for taking the time out, man. Keep up all the great work.
Awesome. Thank you.
Joe Hendry.
Yeah, Joe Hendry. I believe in Joe Hendry. A lot of fun there. The Jays are back in action tonight in Arizona. 9:40 tonight, Yariel Rodriguez against Ryan Nelson. 10:10 tomorrow, Jose Barrios against Yulber Diaz. 4:10 on Sunday, Yusei Kikuchi against Zach Gallen. And then it is the All-Star break. Let's tag in Nick Pecoro of the Arizona Republic. Get the state of the Diamondbacks. We didn't get to talk about yesterday's game where they tied the series against the Braves and split that 1-2-2 because we had to tape it before the game yesterday. But I think everything other than Gabriel Moreno having a back issue is still relevant. Gabriel Moreno played last night. Seems like he's all good. So everything else, good to go. Here's Nick Pecoro of the Arizona Republic.
Joined now by Nick Pecoro of the Arizona Republic. Nick, what's up, man? Thank you for doing this. Good morning.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
All right, so we're recording this on Thursday, so there is a Diamondbacks game that we won't know the result of between now and then. But heading into this one, they've won one of three against the Braves in this series. Kind of been the story of the D-backs season of late. It feels like, you know, kind of hanging right around 500, but not stringing a lot together just yet. Where is this team at kind of at a high level here heading into the All-Star break?
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to get going. They just haven't been able to really maintain any sort of momentum since the season started. You know, you can excuse it to a degree because of all the injuries that they've dealt with. You know, at the moment, they have 3/5 of what they thought was going to be their season opening starting rotation on the injured list. Eduardo Rodriguez hasn't even thrown a pitch for them. Merrill Kelly's been out, you know, for most of the year. And Jordan Montgomery landed on the injured list a couple weeks ago. So, you know, they've been having to put, like, you know, more responsibilities on more guys than they were really expecting. Offensively, it's been a little bit of an up and down team, probably like most lineups in baseball these days. You know, I feel like the numbers probably make it seem like they've been better than they really have been because, you know, they've had a lot of games where they've kind of blown up and then they've been very quiet in a lot of games. So lately, I will say, though, the offense has looked a lot better. They've got their starting group, you know, kind of the group that they were hoping was going to be their group offensively back together and on the field together really for the first time since the first week of the season. And it does feel like they've been a little bit more consistent this past week or two.
Well, that's good. You know, you beat the Dodgers in a series, you beat the Padres in a series. That's something to feel good about and keep building on. So with respect to that rotation, you mentioned the three guys who have been out and who are all, I saw you tweet the other day that they all did bullpen sessions on Tuesday. When you're looking at Merrill Kelly, Jordan Montgomery, Eduardo Rodriguez, do you guys have a sense yet of when the Diamondbacks are getting those guys back? And if you're, you know, if they're getting them back in a way that it's like, okay, these guys are setting into the rotation, you know, the rest of the way here.
Yeah, I think that Jordan Montgomery is going to be the first one back. You know, he's been down the shortest amount of time. It seemed like it was just kind of a minor little nagging knee thing that they wanted to take care of right away. So I think he's going to be back right after the break. The other two still have to build up. They've been down for so long. You know, they haven't been stretched out as, you know, to be able to go 4 or 5 innings. That I'm guessing is going to take into the first or second week of August. But, you know, I don't know. That's the way they have to look at it, right? They have to hope that those guys come back and are their normal selves. It's dicey. You know, everybody knows that when guys are dealing with injuries and trying to come back midseason, you never really know if they're going to be their normal selves. Mm-hmm. The hope is that they jump back in and pitch like they can and provide some stability to this pitching staff.
And even before the injury, Jordan Montgomery hadn't quite looked like the Jordan Montgomery I think the Diamondbacks thought they were getting. A little stop and start to his season, obviously, with the late start there. But he had been struggling. Was there a sense that, you know, they or he had kind of diagnosed what was wrong there, what wasn't clicking for him?
Yeah, Well, I mean, from my perspective, it sort of seemed like it was a bunch of things. You know, every couple of starts, it seemed like they were pinpointing something else that was maybe giving him trouble. He would get encouraged by an outing and then take another step back. I don't know. I mean, I think probably the simplest solution is the one that's the most obvious, and that's that he signed late and he didn't have a spring training and tried to jump in and just, you know, hasn't been able to get into a rhythm and be his normal self. You know, I think that maybe we all, at least I did, kind of overlooked the risk that the Diamondbacks were taking when they gave him that contract right before opening day, and kind of looked at it like, wow, they got Jordan Montgomery. This is fantastic. But like, as we see with Snell, I mean, we saw it a long time ago with, you know, I remember Alex Cobb and Lance Lynn having those issues when they signed late. I don't know when that was, 7-8 years ago, maybe longer. It's just not that easy, especially for pitchers, to miss spring training and just jump right in.
Yeah, it's a tough one for sure. So the result of this is, you know, obviously they've had to call on guys that they didn't expect to call on, but they're also, because they're only, I think they're fourth to last in innings from the starting rotation. You know, it's a pretty good back end of the bullpen, but fair to say that the rest of the bullpen, the shallower part of the bullpen, you know, that churn those guys are asking for length, that's been overexposed a little bit as a result of all the pitching injuries.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think you kind of wonder too, as we get deeper into the season and these guys rack up the appearances, you know, how is that going to affect them? Are they going to be able to maintain their effectiveness into the second half of the season? But you're right. By and large, guys like, you know, Ginkle and Ryan Thompson and Justin Martinez have been terrific. Paul Sewald had a really rough week here, but bounced back and got a save on Wednesday night. He had blown three consecutive chances prior to that. And as you know, with closers, I mean, that's right on that line of like, can you keep going to him? But he had a clean ninth inning against the Braves. So, I mean, that they're hoping obviously that he's back on track, but those guys have been pretty good. I feel like when they've gotten leads, they've been able to maintain them.
So we'll see in this series, Ryan Nelson, Yover Diaz, and Zach Gallen. We know Zach Gallen at this point. I mean, there have been few pitchers as consistent as him since he debuted in 2019. I think the book's kind of out on Nelson as this low strikeout, but yes, low walk guy. What are they looking for from Diaz? I know that, you know, this is a guy who started the year in Double A, had a really good first start against a pretty good Braves team. What are they asking him for here as they kind of patch this together?
Well, if he gives them what he gave them against the Braves, they would be thrilled. He was fantastic. He was throwing a ton of strikes. That's really been the thing. I feel like as I've covered his progression in the minor leagues, most evaluators seem to think, and some still do even after the other day, that his home is probably going to be in the bullpen going forward as like a power reliever late in games. And that's mainly due to, like, you know, the strike throwing, just period throwing strikes, but also the quality of the strikes. But I mean, man, I talked to somebody in the organization after the game the other day, and he's like, well, he proved me wrong. He proved me wrong the other night. I'm still, you know, jury's still out, but like, I think that's really it. I mean, if he can find the strike zone with that stuff, it's an upper 90s fastball. It's power stuff, from I think it's two different breaking balls you can get swings and misses with. So if he's ahead in the count, throwing strikes, he's tough to hit.
All right. So this is a Diamondbacks team again, struggled with some injuries on the pitching side. Their bats have kept them going. I think they're seventh in the league in runs per game. Let's visit a couple of old friends here. How's Lourdes Gurriel doing? You know, this is obviously, Jays fans will argue this trade till 2070. At this point, it seems like Gurriel, two win season last year, re-signs, having another pretty solid year here. Where's he at? How's his season gone?
I think it's been about what you would expect, and probably, I mean, I didn't watch him closely when he was with the Jays, but my understanding is it's always been like this, very streaky. He started the year just on an absolute tear and kind of carried their offense for maybe the first 2 weeks of the season. You know, didn't do much for a long time after that, and then had another stretch, I don't know, maybe in the last 3 to 4 weeks, I think it's kind of slowed down the last few days, where he was, you look up every night, he's getting two hits, and just smoking balls. He just missed a walk-off home run against the Braves on Monday night, that game that Diaz started. He missed it by, you know, just that much. He's been pretty good, though. And defensively, he's been solid. I feel like it isn't the prettiest out there. It's not the smoothest, but I feel like he just makes the plays more often than not. Just a really solid player. You know, not like a model of consistency, but you look up at the end of the year and he's probably going to be right around where he normally is from a stats perspective.
Yeah, I used to joke about his outfield defense that it was just a rope-a-dope. Like, he would take bad routes to the ball because he liked trying to throw guys out. And I know it's not like the best arm, but he gets a lot of assists. And part of it, I think, is he doesn't take the best routes to the ball in the first place. Guys try to take extra base or whatever. Nick, the other part of that trade was Gabriel Moreno, who is the part that Jays fans will want to debate and relitigate forever. I know he got scratched on Wednesday with lower back discomfort. He had just come off the IL and been red hot. Since coming off the IL after that tough kind of offensive start to the season, where is Gabriel Moreno's development, kind of his second full year here?
Yeah, I kind of feel like it's just right on track. I mean, I know he didn't get off to the start he wanted, but the way that he had swung the bat here the last couple of weeks gives you some optimism going into the second half. Weirdly, last year too, he had some shoulder issues, went on the injured list, and then came back. And if you look at, I mean, he didn't spend much time on the injured list last year, but you look right when he came back, he just caught fire and kind of rode it through the rest of the season and into the playoffs as well. And you kind of wonder here, like, you know, it was just a little jammed thumb that he had this time that cost him 10 days or whatever it was. And since he's come back, he's been great. So I don't know, maybe just like a little bit of a recharge or something to kind of, you know, let him kind of get his mind right and kind of have the right perspective on his season. I think guys can press a lot. You know, their numbers aren't where they want them to be, and maybe a little bit of a mental reset can help. I wonder if that's been the case with him both of these years. You know, still same stellar defender, strong arm, you know, good athlete, great bat to ball. You know, we kind of were hoping, I think, after what we saw in October, that there was going to be more power in the bat and that it was going to kind of come a little bit faster. It hasn't yet. But I don't think anybody with the Diamondbacks is disappointed with the you know, what he's given them this year.
And these things happen with you know, second, even third year players. Like, we've seen Julio Rodriguez struggle a little bit as the league kind of figures you out and tries to adjust to you. And then it's on you to figure that back out in return. And someone else who's dealing with that with the Diamondbacks has been Corbin Carroll. You know, bit of a, I guess you'd call it a sophomore slump or something like that at this point. What have you made of his tough time going at the plate this year?
Yeah, it's been strange to see just because he was just so awesome really from start to finish last year. I don't know what to make of it exactly. I mean, his explanation for what happened, particularly the slow start, was he made some changes with his swing in the offseason trying to cover certain pitches and wound up, you know, changing the angle of his swing and just becoming, you know, having a very flat path through the zone, too flat. And it just left him with very little margin for error. And he's been trying to fix that as the season goes along. But, like, you know, there's a reason that when guys, you know, the off season begins, that's when most guys look to make, you know, kind of wholesale changes to their swing. It's just hard to do on the fly when you're trying to, you know, stay afloat and help your team win games. So, you know, they say that it's gotten a little bit better, but the results really haven't been there consistently. It feels like, I don't know, like, it feels like once a night, he'll really hit a ball well. But that's different from, you know, what he was last year when it felt like 2-3 balls a night, he's just scalding. And he just hasn't been able to be that same impact guy as before. I don't think anybody with the Diamondbacks like questions whether, you know, he's going to be a productive player in the long term for them. I don't know. I mean, the way I see it, it just might be not a lost year. I mean, he's still contributing, he's still helping, but like, he's not the same guy. It might just be one of those things where he's going to have to get into the offseason, you know, make those real adjustments that he needs to make, kind of get his swing back to where it was to kind of be the guy of old.
Well, if he can even figure it out to, you know, correct course a little bit here, this is Diamondbacks team, obviously about 33% playoff odds right now from Fangraphs. So they're in the mix. They could use it. And I mean, I guess when your odds are that, I know they're not, you know, all the way leveraged all the way in, but would I be right to believe that the Diamondbacks are probably looking at being, you know, modest buyers at the deadline the way things look right now, or are they a little too on the periphery?
Well, I think they'd like to buy. I think that if today were the deadline or the day they had to make a call, they would. You know, they did well. You mentioned taking series from the Dodgers and the Padres. You know, if they can split against the Braves, that would be nice. You know, I think they just kind of need to not like really fall flat. And that would be enough for Mike Hazen and ownership to push forward, especially after last year and kind of maintaining that momentum from the World Series run. You know, if things go really bad though here the next few weeks, I don't know. Maybe, you know, they find themselves 6-7 games out, you know, behind 5 or 6 teams. It's so bunched up there in that NL wildcard race. You know, they might not have much choice but to either, you know, kind of sit tight or maybe even trade one of their, you know, impending free agents. They're not going to be like tearing down and trading controllable players. They like this group too much. But yeah, I mean, that's what they want. They want to, you know, maybe they add a starter. Maybe they look to add another bat on the infield. I don't know. They could always take a bullpen arm. I know that's something that Mike Hazen has mentioned as well. So we'll just have to see where they are in a couple of weeks. But, you know, as we sit here today, I think they'll try to buy.
That makes for an important couple of weeks of games here, an important series for them heading into the All-Star break with the Jays in town. And it is country night on Friday night, Star Wars night on Saturday night, and Canadian Heritage Day on Sunday. What a, I know. I did not know they are giving away a Diamondbacks hat with a Canadian flag on the side. I knew we had I know snowbirds, but I didn't realize that there was a heavy Canadian summering population in Arizona.
Wow, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you do see some plates driving around. You see a lot of them actually in like the spring. I haven't seen any Ontario plates out here in a while.
Well, maybe you will this weekend. It is Canadian Heritage Day apparently on Sunday. Nick, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Have a great day. Have a great series.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Nick Pecoro of the Arizona Republic. Now you're all set up for Jays Diamondbacks. Let's continue to get you set up for the Major League Baseball draft, which starts on Sunday and runs through Tuesday. We're going to take a break. When we come back, the Blue Jays amateur scouting director, Shane Farrell, joins us as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Major League Baseball draft takes place Sunday through Tuesday. So instead of enjoying things like the Home Run Derby and All-Star Weekend, our next guest will be in the war room making some big picks. The Jays select at number 20 and number 59 over the first two rounds. And then, of course, the draft is 20 rounds, expanding 3 days. We're joined now by Toronto Blue Jays amateur scouting director, Shane Farrell. Shane, I know this is a very busy week, so appreciate you taking the time out. At this stage in the process, is it excitement for you, impatience? Where are you at?
Hey, Blake, thanks for having me on. It's, you know, these days are filled with a lot of excitement and a lot of opportunity, and we're looking forward to Sunday and making a couple selections that are going to be impactful players for us in the long haul.
At this late in the process, so draft starts Sunday, are things still, obviously who goes 1 through 19 is not something you can control, but are your boards still in flux? Are you guys still debating things, or is it pretty much set at this point and you're just kind of waiting for Sunday to roll around?
No, there's still a lot of quality conversation going on, you know, throughout our entire staff. You know, we're spending a lot of time in the room talking through certain demographics and certain blocks of players that we have lined up against one another. And, you know, again, it's been a lot of hard work by our entire scouting staff and our draft process. It's been really thorough and, you know, some minor changes coming over the next couple of days in advance of Sunday.
Well, it's pretty exciting, and you know, you've had some experience now with a few of these. I think this is your fifth as amateur scouting director for the Blue Jays. This is, you know, this front office's ninth. When you look back at the work you guys have done over the last couple of years, how do you evaluate successes and failures through the draft, where there are such long timelines for guys, you know, to get to the majors or to you know, guys get traded and things like that? How do you kind of year to year evaluate the work that you guys do?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to evaluate in the moment, just for the reasons you mentioned, knowing how much time has to pass for a career to unfold. I think the one thing we can do is always reflect on our process and our decision-making and how we're using the information to make our selections. You know, we feel like we've been able to make selections that have helped our major league team contribute at important times and make playoff runs. And, you know, I think we're looking forward to continuing to add to that.
Where would you, you know, when you look at these last couple drafts, where would you say, you know, if you were to point to one, the strength of this group lies in terms of, you know, guys or demographics or types you've identified and developed well or less well? Where would you say the strength of your team is?
You know, I think where we've had success are some of the, you know, higher contact college bats. You know, you can point to a case like Alan Roden or Josh Kasevich, guys that are coming into a little bit more power, which has been a nice addition to their game. Josh obviously playing, you know, a premium position at shortstop and doing that quite well combined with his contact. I think he's going to be a valuable player. Alan Roden, what he's been able to do to make some mechanical adjustments and work really well alongside our player development staff to get to some more power. I think we've seen some nice growth in those areas.
When it comes to that particular skill set, you know, these guys that have the contact ability, I know you guys value players who have a you know, a refined approach at the plate, or at least a mature approach at the plate relative to their age and level. Is that kind of, you know, when you guys are thinking through these decisions, talking to the player development side of the organization, thinking through things like, hey, what skills are easy? Like, is it easier to develop power and bring that power out of a guy than teach a guy to have a refined approach at the plate? How much of that goes into this, the decision-making, where the player development strengths also lie?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's something we're constantly trying to further involve our player development staff and our coaches throughout the organization into our draft process, knowing that they're going to be the ones working with them day in and day out, and you know, making sure that the organization is aligned in player selection and how that feeds into our development system and our development strengths and path moving forward. And I think those are highlighted by a couple of guys I just mentioned, and Alan Roden and Kasevich.
There are also, you know, there's also a trade-off, you know, potentially there with, you know, college bats with the bat-to-ball profile who don't have the power. You know, maybe that's a high floor, lower ceiling type versus, you know, you guys take Arjun Namala last year who, you know, is all upside, right, and having a nice couple weeks at Dunedin here. What is it like working through that element of it, the, you know, kind of projectability or safe floor versus the ultimate upside, the guys who really move the needle if they work?
Yeah, it's challenging, but each draft class is different, and you know, where your pick falls that year also presents a different challenge as well. I mean, you mentioned Arjun being a bit of the antithesis compared to the college bat contact first profile. We feel like that was an upside play that we felt excited to acquire at our pick. Somebody that plays a premium position, we feel is going to stay up the middle at shortstop and potentially provide a great deal of power and you know, be a key figure in the middle of the lineup on a contending club.
So that's you know, an upside question there with respect to a position player. And this is maybe not the right year to ask this next question, at least at the top of the draft, based on what the scouting people have told me and stuff. But how do you, you know, there's also the element of injury volatility, especially for prep arms in the draft. You guys have obviously taken a couple of those guys, you know, had a couple guys like Tiedemann and Morautis who prior to injury were starting to move through the system and kind of, you know, their status was higher than where you drafted them. Obviously, Barriera has had some injury stuff. Is there any sort of way to kind of capture that or contextualize that? Yeah, these arms are not only riskier projection wise, but also injury wise.
Yeah, sure. I think it's the inherent risk in selecting from that demographic. I think the things we're always focusing on are arm action delivery, physicality and diving into, their routines, their work habits, how well they take care of their body, what their commitment to their routine between starts is and things like that. Really getting to know the person that can potentially help mitigate some health risks by what kind of worker they are.
I would imagine some of those intangibles, interviews with the player, talking to their coaches and teammates and things like that are also, really important in general, but I'd imagine is it fair to assume that those kind of things are a little bit, take on a greater importance with prep prospects because, the data or the modeling and things like that just aren't as rich at that level. You do have to do a little bit more of the, for lack of a better term, more of the old school scouting approach with high school guys versus college guys?
Certainly. And that's where, our scouts are spending a great deal of time and energy and focus and in learning as much about each individual player in their area as possible, getting to know them, not only who they are on the field and between the lines, but what they're like off the field and what their work habits are and how they are in the community and things like that. So it's all full and encompassing and trying to learn as much about the person as we can, not just only the player and what we're seeing in uniform.
And that's, that is obviously important organizational culturally, the culture around the teams and things like that. You mentioned how they fit into the community and things. Do you when we look at a guy, let's say there's two guys next to each other and they have the same kind of skill set now and the same kind of upside, do those intangibles kind of factor into, hey, what is the likelihood this guy actually reaches the ceiling that we see? Do you try to use that to capture kind of developmental capacity, like how much a guy might actually be able to do the work and take coaching and unlock that upside?
Sure. At the end of the day, we're acquiring people. And what makes those people tick and their commitment to their craft is extremely important. And that can certainly be a separator when it comes time to make a decision.
So on the other side of that is of course, we have a lot more data on guys now, especially at the college level than we had not that long ago. How has that changed? And I know you've only been in this specific role for 5 years, but you've been around the game and that side of the game for a long time. How has greater access and availability of, exit velocities, pitcher shape and movement and things like that, or even just the efficiency of being able to look at the entire college class, how has that changed the process for you guys?
Yeah, I think scouting and the draft in general has evolved quite a bit over the last decade. I think having the information is one thing, but the ability to apply it to your draft process and your decision-making process is another. I think identifying what is important to you, what are the foundational pieces that you want a player to have and what you feel like you can develop around those foundational pieces is really important.
You guys have had some success with later round Canadian prospects as well. Guys like Connor O'Halloran who have moved through the system fairly quickly. Sam Shaw, who's having, by all reports, a nice start at the complex system level here. Obviously, you don't draft guys just because they're Canadian, but do you feel that there's, a bit of an advantage knowing this market, knowing this player base a little bit better on this side of the border?
I do. I feel like our access and the amount of pride our staff takes in finding the best talent in the country here is really important and something we're always talking about and working hard to acquire.
You had spoke on a Zoom with a bunch of us on Wednesday about the learning of your group and improving the processes and things like that. And again, acknowledging that we can't necessarily evaluate the draft results for years and years and years. What does that mean? What does that look like when you say that, the learning and the improvement of the processes for your team has been something that stood out to you over the last couple of years? What does that look like to you?
I think it's just a constant reflection of our process and how we're using our people and how we are focusing our time and energy in the appropriate places where we feel the talent and the makeup of the prospect line up, and we feel like it is a person and a player that we want to add to the organization.
Okay, this is a bit of a silly one, and maybe you won't actually give me an answer, but you know, leave passport aside, and maybe, you know, the age of the prospect aside. Is there one trait that like really stands out to you? Like if you're kind of sorting by X to, hey, these are Shane Farrell type guys. And they don't have to be guys you drafted necessarily, but a particular, you know, standout foundational skill that you really believe in.
Maybe not a physical skill, but I think resiliency and ability to handle failure. I think this is a really difficult game, and you know, you're failing 7 out of 10 times as a hitter, and you're succeeding at a high level. So being able to handle the ups and downs over a very, very long season, especially as a young player, being thrown into situations that you've never experienced before. You know, maybe a 17, 18, 19-year-old player right out of high school. I think understanding how that individual is going to handle that failure and disappointment, but not be deterred by that, to continue to press on, commit even deeper to their work habits and their routines. I think those are really the separators and the things we're working to identify and bring more and more of into the organization.
And goes back well to the start of this conversation when we talked about, you know, those intangibles and reaching your actual development potential and things like that. So that's a good answer. Shane, last one before I let you go on with your work. Who are you taking at number 20, man?
You'll find out on Sunday.
All right. Shane Farrell, Amateur Scouting Director of the Toronto Blue Jays. Thank you so much for taking the time out. Good luck this weekend.
Yeah, thanks, Blake.
Shane Farrell, Toronto Blue Jays Amateur Scouting Director. Again, the draft starts Sunday, runs through Tuesday, 20 rounds. Jays pick number 20 in the first round, number 59 overall as well. That'll be on MLB Network, which is, of course, available in Canada. It'll be on ESPN at least the first day. And I believe all of it, or some alternate stream of everything, streams on MLB.com. So you can check that out. Did a little bit of a piece on Blue Jays Central last night on a couple of the Canadian prospects that we've talked about as well. So in addition to the Jays picks, those guys are ready to, those guys are worth keeping an eye on as well. A little bit of news. We talked to Madison Shipman earlier in the show about if she would start Paul Skeens in the All-Star game. Guess who's starting the All-Star game? Paul Skeens. So that's kind of, that's pretty cool there. So the bottom of the first, it'll be, if they go with the lineup we assume they'll go with, it'll be Paul Skeens against Gunnar Henderson, Juan Soto, Aaron Judge. That'll be a blast. Last night, by the way, for anyone who missed it, they pulled Paul Skeens after 7 innings of no-hit ball. He was in the high 90s for pitches. We basically never see rookies go over 106 pitches. I don't know, man. They're probably going to shut him down in the second half. He was throwing 125 pitches regularly last year in college. Man, I get it, but let the guy cook. Let him get that no-hitter. Come on. All right, couple updates for you on the Blue Jays side and a couple non-updates outside of the Paul Skeens, the draft, and the All-Star weekend ahead here. So I mentioned earlier the Kevin Kiermaier kind of awkwardness. So let me explain the situation a little bit as I understand it. So Kevin Kiermaier was placed on waivers. That's not supposed to be something that comes out and we find out about during a game and Kevin Kiermaier has to be told about after the game. Normally that's a sealed process. Joel Sherman of the New York Post first reported that. The term revocable waivers was used. That no longer exists. That's if you remember the post-trade deadline, when we could do trades in August, guys would be put on waivers. If they were claimed, you could pull them back off of waivers. If they cleared waivers, you were then free to trade them, that kind of thing. Those don't exist anymore. So what I think Joel meant by that is that the intention is not necessarily to release Kevin Kiermaier off the team. If he gets claimed, he's claimed. But the revocable part that I think Joel was referring to was that if he clears waivers, the Jays might just keep him on the roster. There's not, he played last night despite being on waivers. So this is, you know, a bit of an awkward dynamic here, especially a couple weeks before the trade deadline. This is something you see a little bit more often after the trade deadline. So even though post-trade deadline trade waivers don't exist anymore, like we saw the Angels last year put half the roster on waivers to try to save some money. And that is at the root of this Kiermaier gambit here. So there are a couple of possible explanations for this, and they all work hand in hand. So the first is, you know, hey, you want to give them absolute benefit of the doubt. It's, hey, Kevin Kiermaier, this is a chance to maybe latch on with a contender and a bench role. The Jays are doing this for the Blue Jays, not necessarily for Kevin Kiermaier. Second one is, hey, you free up playing time in a roster spot. The second half of this year is going to be about auditioning young guys. That's a legitimate part of this. And Kevin Kiermaier, you know, to his admission after the game, hasn't played particularly well, particularly hit very well this year. He's at 0.0 wins above replacement. He's hitting .091, a .533 OPS. Still, obviously, elite plus defense and pretty high-end speed. But we're talking like almost a career low in walk rate, career high in strikeout rate, career low contact rate, career high chase rate, career low line drive rate. Like, everything's in the wrong direction for Kiermaier here. If a contender is going to grab him, it's probably as a defensive replacement type. So that's the non-financial part of this. The financial part of this is that the Blue Jays are currently spending into the competitive balance tax. And from a fan perspective, you probably don't care that Rogers is spending a lot of money, and that's fair. But there are a couple considerations here. The first is that if they were to duck out of the competitive balance tax entirely, so they need to shave about 10 or 11 million off of their payroll for the rest of the season to get below the competitive balance tax based on the estimates that we have. If you can duck below that competitive balance tax line, a couple of things happen in addition to the money you save. The first is that if you offer one of your free agents a qualifying offer after the season, so you don't trade Danny Jansen and you qualify him, you don't trade Yusei Kikuchi and you qualify him, whatever, you get a better compensation pick back if they leave, if you're a non-tax team. Similarly, if you go and you sign someone who was given a qualifying offer by their team, you give up less draft compensation if you are not a tax team. So those are two important roster building things from a draft pick perspective, from a what it costs you to sign a qualified guy. The other thing is, and this is money related, but you got to be realistic about the budgets that the team operates within. If the Jays stay above the collective, the competitive balance tax line, next year, if they spend into the competitive balance tax, it's their third year in a row as a tax team. That means the tax rate on those overtures is 50%. If you can get under the tax line this year and then get back to it next year, that drops the 20% because you're not considered a repeater and you're not a third-year repeater. And I know, again, a lot of fans are just, well, Rogers has the money, spend it. You can have that perspective, but if the team is operating within a budget, this is a way to potentially not only save real dollars, but make your money go a little further next year. Kevin Kiermaier being waived alone doesn't do that, but it does signal to me a little bit that is a part of their thinking here. My counter to that, and again, I just laid it out, I understand it all. My counter to that would be, you're a big market team, you don't want to be selling, so you have to be selling here, and it's an unfortunate situation. Use that big market financial muscle to eat a little money when you trade a guy away, get a better prospect back. You think back to the Francisco Liriano acquisition, not even trading him for Teoscar, but you pick up Liriano, Reese McGuire, Harold Ramirez, all for Drew Hutchison. A lot of that had to do with eating the Liriano money. We see it every deadline. Teams get, you know, Aaron Saval only returns the number 21 to 25 prospect in the Brewers system. Even if you like that guy, you know, if the Rays are a team that can eat the money on that because the Brewers aren't a huge budget team, maybe that prospect capital improves. So that's another way to use your financial flexibility as well. It'd be interesting to see how the Blue Jays play this out. Bo Bichette, by the way, is day-to-day. An IL stint is possible. They're expecting to add someone to the taxi squad in Arizona just in case. Dalton Varsho didn't play yesterday either. He is day-to-day as well. Jimmy Garcia expected to throw in a game at some point at AAA. I don't believe he got into that game last night, although admittedly I turned it off before the end. Eric Swanson did get into that one. No IKF update, no Ricky Tiedemann updates. Still waiting to hear if they find anything in those additional imagings, if they come up with a surgical plan versus a rehab plan. No real update on Adam Macko yet either. So a lot to keep an eye on in the not only the updates today from John Schneider before the series, but the updates in that first series coming out of the All-Star break when Detroit is here July 19th, 2021. I imagine that July 19th date will be a huge news day, and then we'll have 2 weeks of huge news days with the trade deadline on the 30th. Jays Diamondbacks this weekend. This is a Diamondbacks team that has pulled back to 500 and within one game of the wild card. They've gone 8-4 over the last 12, won a series against Oakland, the Dodgers, the Padres, and split a four set against the Braves. So they've got their playoff odds back almost to 40%. They're in the mix here. They're a top 10 offense, borderline top five offense, near the bottom of the league in run prevention. So maybe this is a high scoring affair. Ryan Nelson tonight, 5.08 ERA. This is who he is. Doesn't strike out a lot of guys, barely misses bats. He doesn't really walk anyone. He's got big reverse platoon splits too, but I can't really figure it out because the changeup's really bad. So I'm not particularly sure why that's the case. Not a big believer in reverse platoon splits, as you probably know if you're a regular as well. Yariel Rodriguez on the other side, coming off of two awesome starts, 12 2/3 innings, only one run allowed, and three hits with 12 strikeouts. So a lot of fun there to see how Yariel can build on that. It's 9:40 tonight. It's Dan, Joe, and Hazel on the call, Brad and Caleb for Blue Jay Central, Eric Smith and Madison Shipman on the radio side, and then BNS has you covered for .ca. Show Ali has you post-game for Jays Talk. Blair and Barker coming at you 4 to 6. Thank you to Shane Farrell, Joe Hendry, Madison Shipman, Russell Dorsey, and Nick Pecoro. Thank you, as always, to Andrew Adams, Amit Mon, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Have a terrific weekend, everyone.